everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. A very happy December to you. What is it? December 21st. Oh, it's winter. First day of winter. Don't we love that? No matter where you are, I hope you are warm and comfortable. And thank you for joining me today. As you know, on It's All About Food, we talk about my favorite subject, food, and its impact on health, environment, and animals. And there's just so many different interesting things going on about food. Some of it's really great and delicious, and some of it is quite unbelievable. And we're going to be talking about some of that frustrating, unbelievable stuff today, and I have a great guest today. Michelle Simon is a public health lawyer who has been researching and writing about the food industry and food politics since 1996. She specializes in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics that harm the public's health. She is president of Eat, Drink Politics, an industry watchdog consulting firm. Michelle Simon has taught health policy at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law, and lectures frequently on corporate tactics and policy solutions. She has written extensively on the politics of food, and her first book, Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back, was published by Nations Books in 2006. She has a master's degree in public health from Yale University and has received her law degree from the University of California, Hastings College of the Law. I want you to all shout with me together, I am mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, and welcome Michelle Simon to It's All About Food.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Great. I wish there were a gazillion of you, Michelle.
Well, I do what I can. You know, there are. Actually, there are more and more all the time. They're just not, you know, as visible maybe.
Yeah. Well, it's so confusing. It's hard to know who to trust. And very often when I'm kind of confused, I go to your sites because I know that I can trust you. So just for people to know, you have two websites, appetiteforprofit.com. with a great blog, and then eatdrinkpolitics.com. So what's going on in the food industry world? You know, there seems to be so many different things. Every day there's something so scary happening.
Well, there is a lot going on, but, you know, I think the good news is increasingly there's more information to uncover what's going on, and there's increasing awareness. Unfortunately, that's still relegated to a relatively small part of the population, but, you know, there are all kinds of efforts going on to spread that information. The trouble is so many people still live in parts of the country where even if they have access to information, they don't have access to the actual healthy food that is optimum for their health. So, you know, that's where policy change comes in, and that's where we really have to build a broader political movement.
Yeah, I'm traveling a bit, and normally when I live in New York City and I don't have a car, so I particularly frequent the places that I'm interested in going to on foot. But I'm in California right now, and we rented a car so I can get around a little bit more, and I'm kind of seeing a little bit more of what's going on in the world. And I guess some of the good things are stores like Target and others are now serving more, quote, healthy food. Somebody had to make that happen.
I'm not going to food shop there,
but, you know, they have bananas and lettuce there now, which is just interesting. I don't think where I am right now it's that critical, but in areas where they don't have access to a lot of healthy food, sometimes in stores like that, it's beneficial to find some fruit and vegetables.
Yeah, it really depends on the area. So some evidence suggests that when big box stores like Target or certainly Walmart, when stores like that come in, sometimes under the guise of, you know, saving a poor neighborhood or area from being a food desert, the opposite happens. There was actually just a report out from New York City where Walmart wants to go in to Harlem, and they did an analysis to show, based on the experience in Chicago, where there are now three Walmarts, the surrounding stores, many of them shut down, and so the impact can actually be negative in terms of, you know, the net loss of food stores in a neighborhood. So having a Walmart in an urban area has a very different impact than, say, in a, well, of course, it has the same devastating economic impacts no matter where they are. But the other thing to keep in mind is these big box stores, I mean, they don't, it's not just a food issue, there's also the labor, you know, just complete devastation of the standards for labor with a store like Walmart coming in, and evidence has been borne out that they are a drain on the local economy because people who are having, you know, can't even live on these low wages that Walmart pays. I mean, I know we're, you know, going into a whole new area here, but you know, it's
that's
not
okay. We can jump around. It's all
okay.
It's all connected,
right? And so to just say, you know, oh well, look at these great big stores that are selling produce. That's true, and that does help maybe for some people that are able to drive to that store. Mm-hmm. But many people in poor areas don't have that kind of transportation, and so there are just reverberations throughout any area. What we really need is localized solutions to this problem in terms of small stores, farmers markets, local ways to get fresh food into neighborhoods that is sustainable for the local economy.
In New York City, we don't need a Walmart, and we have all different kinds of suppliers of food, and fortunately there are a lot of farmers in the area, and there's a lot of people that are making it possible to get healthy food into the area. Now, I know that in the area of Harlem, there are some pockets where people have more challenging needs and access to healthy food. But I know Walmart's been trying to get into different areas of New York City, and we're fighting it. They tried to get into near my neighborhood in Queens, and it didn't happen. And, you know, it's just frightening to hear that they want to get into Harlem. But, okay, we need to do whatever we can to keep them out.
Right, yeah. I mean, and that's, you know, Walmart's game is expansion. You know, I mean, they are the fastest growing retailer, and they expanded into grocery just like in the last 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And within that time, they've become the largest, you know, they've surpassed all the other huge chains. I mean, it's
right.
It's sad
day
when you start
going, supporting the big box stores at all, but those that are already in place, unfortunately, I guess the lesser of all the evils is for them to have some food.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I don't have a problem with supermarkets. I mean, those are really important,
yeah,
in any
absolutely.
Neighborhood. That's different than a store like Walmart, which is
mm-hmm.
just a monster. Yeah.
That evil monster. Okay. So a lot of people want to trust the government to some degree and believe that we have regulatory policies and groups in place that are going to keep our food safe, keep our food for our children and our schools and our stores safe and healthy. And more we're learning that there's more to it, and we unfortunately can't trust them to some degree. And maybe this is becoming more prevalent now that so many things have gone wrong with the economy, and we know that the government has not been behind the 99% in making
right.
things livable for the common folk. So what are some of the things I know I get really confused. We hear a lot of sound bites about all kinds of different things. And sometimes I believe some of the sound bites, sometimes I don't, and then I try and find like the House bill or the Senate bill or a piece of legislation and read what's really going on. And sometimes people are making scares that aren't necessarily true, but a lot of times they are true. There's a lot of things that are really hard to understand in legislation, even
yeah.
for our congresspeople.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's why we have lobbyists. I mean, you know, that's the sad reality is that lobbyists have sort of filled in a lot of the gaps where even people whose job it is to not only understand legislation that they're voting on but actually write it, those two functions have largely been taken over by corporate lobbyists. Because, you know, they obviously have the time and resources to be in there, and so many legislators are just overwhelmed with what's going on. But, you know, there are staffers, of course, that fill in those gaps as well. But the point is that corporate lobbyists really have so much power. And this is also, you know, why we don't have a level playing field when it comes to policymaking. So, yes, it can be complicated, but part of the game that corporate America plays is to obscure policy making, make policy out to be way more complicated than it really is or has to be, and that way, you know, the common folk are just, you know, too busy watching Dancing with the Stars to notice that, you know, Congress has just passed one of the most devastating, you know, threats to civil rights that we've seen in a long time with this recent bill to, you know, arrest Americans at the slight hint of anything that sounds like terrorism. So, you know, there's a lot that's just part and parcel of the game that's played in Washington. Mm-hmm. Other aspects of it that are maybe a little more nefarious. But the bottom line is we have a broken political system which favors corporate interests and moneyed interests over the rest of us that, you know, don't have those kinds of resources. But what we do have is, you know, the people on our side, and we're seeing, you know, for example, with the growing Occupy movement, we're seeing pockets of resistance and frustration being expressed in a number of ways. And so, you know, I do think there is hope in that people are mad as hell and aren't going to take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it remains to be seen where that anger and frustration will go. But you know, I do think there is a growing sentiment.
And nothing's going to happen unless people insist on it. And I like your bringing up people watching Dancing with the Stars. It's not particularly that program, but just sitting back and thinking things are going to happen without each of us individually getting involved in one way or another. And that doesn't mean that we have to be politically involved, but we can be involved with our dollars. We can be involved in our communities. There's just so many things. We need to be paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
So you just...
Right. And
you mentioned briefly something that the government passed with regard to calling people terrorists. Can you?
Yeah, well, that's not. I mean, that's not related to food. It's just a piece of legislation that got passed. But I don't really know the details about it. I just know people were really up in arms about it because it had to do with sort of ignoring something called due process, which is in our Constitution. And
this is a recent regulation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the point is that these things happen while people aren't paying attention or because there's some, you know, I don't know what lobbied interest would have been behind that necessarily, but you never know if it's, you know, the prison industrial complex or some, you know, military unit that is going to get some kind of government contracts, et cetera. I mean, odds are any piece of legislation that gets pushed through, you know, without much kind of public scrutiny, there's some moneyed interest behind it, and that's just how our system works.
Yeah. I want to talk about some specifics. So you've written a number mm-hmm. of blog articles and some journal articles, and I thought we might touch on some of them because it really highlights what's going on and might clarify some confusion or things that people should really focus on. So sometimes we talk on this show about labeling and how hard it is to figure out what's going on nutrition labels and what to pay attention to, and the fact that they're in really small print that makes it even more difficult for a lot of people who don't want to put their reading glasses on.
Mm-hmm.
And you recently had an article printed in the Journal of Hunger and Environmental Nutrition about regulating the front of package labeling.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So, you know, back in 1990, we had a law passed that requires nutrition labeling that you see on back of packages or on the sides of packages. That's the nutrition facts label that says how many calories and has a breakdown of various nutrients and ingredients are required to be labeled there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all subject to FDA law. You know, industry can't monkey with that. It has to be strictly followed. So, but the front of package is kind of a free-for-all, and that's the most important real estate, which is how industry and marketers refer to it, because that's where, you know, at the point of sale, a shopper is making a crucial decision about whether to buy, you know, Coke or Pepsi.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea there is to use in any way possible what are called call-outs or other forms of marketing to grab the shopper's attention. And what that has resulted in is all kinds, especially in an increasing environment where people are more aware of their health, we've seen an increasing encroachment of really illegal health claims on the front of package. Over the years, the FDA has set some guidelines for the types of health claims that can be made on the front of a package. So things like low salt or low sugar, those have specific FDA definitions, or helps lower cholesterol. There are certain claims that industry can make, but only subject to certain FDA guidelines. Okay, so anything outside of that has been pretty much a free-for-all. And so in order to kind of get a handle on this problem, we've had an effort by FDA to start thinking about how to put additional regulations on these sorts of marketing claims. And we've also had an arm of Congress called the Institute of Medicine, which is a committee of experts to look at this issue and come up with recommendations.
Can we trust them?
Yes. Actually, okay. The Institute of Medicine is one of the rare bodies that can be trusted for the most part. I mean, it's not to say there aren't politics involved, but the whole kind of thinking behind the Institute of Medicine is that they are an independent body. They will be commissioned by Congress for a report. Committee members will be selected. But for the most part, IOM reports are held up as sort of, you know, an actual place to look for good science.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, you know, then what happens between the scientific recommendations and, you know, the political black box is a whole other story. But the point is that IOM has made certain recommendations. The FDA is sort of sitting on it. And the purpose of my article was to really ask the question, is this whole exercise in trying to come up with, you know, for example, putting number of grams of sugar or grams of salt on the front of package, and these are the sorts of ideas that are being considered, is this really necessary, or is it an exercise in futility, given that, first of all, the same information is already in the nutrition facts label, and secondly, do we really need to be kind of wringing our hands over how to, you know, slap a healthy label on processed food?
Mm-hmm.
Because really what we need to be turning to as a nation is eating not food that comes in a box with a label, but real food that comes from nature, that's grown in the ground, that, you know, we buy hopefully locally if we have access to our local farmers market.
Yep.
So it's not to say that, you know, I mean, we all rely on packaged foods from time to time. I do as well. But it just seems to me that by, and of course industry is all over this and has their own set of guidelines now that they're following. They call it the nutrition keys. Well, first it was called the nutrition keys. I think they've since changed it to some other silly name called Facts Up Front. I mean, this is the game that industry plays. Whenever there's a threat coming down from the federal government, any governmental body, to their business practice, they try to co-opt the process by saying, no, 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 we don't need any government intervention. We've got it covered. We've got our own great system. And, of course, it is to their benefit, right, to be calling out certain nutrition information and so forth. But it just confuses the consumer because usually it doesn't really tell you anything helpful. It's just more marketing. So the purpose of the article was to kind of put all this into context and say, you know, let's stop worrying about this whole front of package nonsense. We definitely want to stop industry from making deceptive claims, and there's plenty of those to be stopped. But, you know, we don't really need more nutrition labeling. Just turn the package over, you know, you may even burn a calorie picking up the box, turning it over to see the nutrition facts, which is pretty clear. I mean, of course, there's always room for improvement. But the information is pretty much there, at least for the type of information that they're talking about putting on the front of the package. It would really be redundant. Instead, what we need, of course, is, you know, my joke about is it enough to just, for example, tell folks who walk into a McDonald's how many calories is in that Big Mac. And my joke is you'd have to attach a copy of Fast Food Nation to every hamburger so to really give consumers the enough information to go on what's going on. So, you know, just having a few more points of data isn't really going to fix the mess we're in.
We need to change the way we think about food.
Right.
Yeah. I like that. I don't hear that very much. You know, a lot of people focus on getting the label right, and we really need to rethink the whole thing. It's not the label. It's eating fresh, whole, locally grown, organic plant foods.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So we need to shift that thought. Very good. Okay, let's move on to, well, can we talk a little bit about marketing to children? It's such a scary thing, and we see it in so many different ways, and we've seen it with kids' cereals specifically. You know, I'm personally just a straight oatmeal person. Just give me oatmeal, raisins, fresh fruit. But most kids are eating just horrible things out of a box with toys.
Right.
And pictures.
Yes. Yes, well, you know, the food industry has done a very good job of kind of creating a whole separate sector of food aimed at children when, you know, there's no need for kids to have special food. I mean, kids can eat oatmeal just like you do, but that wouldn't help the likes of Kellogg's and General Mills. And so instead they've invented a whole category of children's cereal that they've just loaded up with sugar because kids do have a sweet tooth. And then adding fuel to the fire, they market these products with all kinds of child-friendly cartoons and then engage in cross-marketing arrangements with companies like Nickelodeon so that you have all the favorite cartoon characters that children love on these boxes, and all that results in what industry calls the nag factor or pester power, which is which any parent knows who's tried to take a small child through the cereal aisle. And they also position these products at a child's eye level. So next time you're in the supermarket, if you haven't noticed already, you'll see at the 2 or 3 foot level are all the children's cereals, whereas the higher you go are the more adult-oriented cereals. So there are many ways that marketers manipulate the environment for children to be targeted with their messages. And so there is a growing hue and cry about this problem has been really going on for decades now, and yet we can't seem to get much traction at the national level anyway, because the same reasons that we've been talking about, the food industry has just done a bang-up job at keeping government at bay, thanks to putting a lot of money into the federal government. And in particular, we've had this experience in the last 2 years of an effort by the federal government to simply put voluntary guidelines around how industry markets to children. So the feds have pretty much given up the idea of actually regulating the marketing to children. So instead, they embarked on a process to engage in actually setting scientific standards for how the food industry could improve its marketing practices. So you know, limiting the amount of sugar, salt, and fat, and so forth. This process has been dragged on because industry went ballistic. I mean, this is to show how much they don't want anyone telling them what to do, even though this is all always going to be a voluntary process. And so they went to their friends in Congress and have the most recent sort of almost nail in the coffin. Well, we're not sure yet, but their attempt to put the nail in the coffin has been inserting language into the recent budget bill that was passed to require a cost-benefit analysis of this report that is trying to be finalized by these four agencies led by the Federal Trade Commission. And it makes no sense, either from a legal perspective or just a common sense one, because, like I said, this is meant to be voluntary. So how can you do a cost-benefit analysis on something that we don't even know if any of the food industry is going to take up? But no matter, this is just a big stall tactic, and it may be the end of this report. Like I said, we're not sure if that's the case, but it seems likely that we won't see anything more about this. So
now, one thing specifically that's happened recently is with McDonald's in San Francisco and their little toy that they give with the Happy Meal. And I was reading a bit about that and how some of the legislation to prevent them marketing to kids with a free toy is kind of blown up a little bit.
Right.
Because corporations always look for the way out around laws.
Right. Yes, that's what they hire lobbyists for to write the laws. And then when they don't get to do that, they then hire lawyers to get them to figure out a way around the law. So in this instance, this was an effort by San Francisco to not ban. It was longly called the Happy Meal ban. It was never meant to ban anything. It was meant to simply put some, again, reasonable nutrition guidelines on restaurants who choose to use toys as incentives and other incentives that are targeted to children. And so, of course, McDonald's being the largest purveyor of this idea with their Happy Meals kind of became the target and did the most heavy-duty lobbying to stop that local ordinance from going through. But the community prevailed through a lot of community organizing. The bill did pass and then was just set to go into effect in December 1st. And then McDonald's announced that they had found a way around it by charging 10 cents. So unfortunately, the bill was worded to only apply to free incentives, and so McDonald's is saying that they're now charging 10 cents to get around that language. And I'm not convinced that that's actually an adequate way to get around it, and I've talked to some others that, agree that they could just be playing games with how they're pricing the Happy Meals now, but nevertheless, that's what they've done. So instead of actually improving the nutrition quality of the food that they're serving to children, God forbid they should do that. Of course, they announced that they're doing that on their own, but it's not nearly sufficient to meet the San Francisco guidelines. Instead of doing the right thing, they found a way to skirt the law.
Well, this 10 cents, I was reading the actual cost of the toy. It's worth more than 10 cents.
Right, right, which is why it's very suspect that, that this is an adequate get around. But, and it remains to be seen how San Francisco will respond. We're not hearing anything out of the city attorney's office about what they think of all this, but who knows, something may happen in the next few months.
Right. Well, Michelle, I want to talk about a few more items, but I think maybe we can take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about nutrients in alcohol. I want to talk about jumping jacks. I want to talk about the milk industry a little bit. There's just so many things to talk about, but let's take a quick break, and we'll be back in a couple minutes. Thanks. Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And I'm here today with Michelle Simon, and we are talking about the food industry and food politics. So I'm always promoting a healthy plant-based diet to my friends, my family, my listeners, and encouraging people to eat more whole, fresh, locally grown, organic fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, raw nuts and seeds, trying to minimize the amounts of processed foods that we eat and getting into the kitchen and preparing more of our own foods, and that way we can keep track and control of the added sugar and salt and oil and all those things that affect our health. And one of the things that I personally don't like is I don't like to buy foods that are fortified with vitamins. I like to eat whole foods that have the vitamins in them naturally. Sometimes when we get foods that have added vitamins to it, we may be getting too much of something, or we may be getting something that really doesn't work well unless it has a whole bunch of other things we haven't even identified yet that come in whole foods. And now, they're even adding nutrients to alcohol. How crazy is this?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, one industry sees another one doing something crazy, and they figure they might as well copy it. So,
and people and are buying it.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, I mean, why not? Marketers tell you to buy it. I mean, there's nobody telling you not to buy it, or very few people compared
right,
to
Right, well, we're telling you not to buy it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but the marketers have a bigger budget than PRN does. So
right.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the thing. People, I think, need to have, especially educated sort of, I don't know, upper middle class, people need to have more sympathy. I think I hear this a lot. Well, you know, people are just too stupid if they don't realize that eating McDonald's every day is bad for you. You know, why should people realize that? Who really is telling them? The federal government? You know, do you think the average person, you know, barely making ends meet is really paying attention to the My Plate diagram that, you know, the First Lady is promoting? I mean,
yeah, I don't think so.
Let's be real, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, all they're seeing are messages from McDonald's to tell them to come be happy, just spend a dollar, it'll taste good, and, you know, go on with
and
your
then
day.
They see, and then they see commercials for the drugs that are going to take care of the pain that they have or the problems that they have from eating these horrible
right.
foods.
Right. Right, right.
Yeah.
We have a medical system that's built on treatment and not prevention. And so, you know, this is just, it's in sociology, it's called normalizing. And what's normal, people are just doing what's normal. And it's actually outside the norm to not be eating fast food every day or to be eating a diet the way you described. And it actually, it takes more than just knowledge and willpower. It means going against a very strong social tide. And that's another factor that I think often doesn't get taken into account by some smug vegetarians I know who think people just need to wise up and stop eating meat. It's like, well, if you, you know, are in a social circle where everyone else eats meat, your entire family eats meat,
mm-hmm.
it's very difficult to then step
yeah.
outside that normal pattern of behavior and say, I'm going to, you know, go eat these plant foods. And, you know, it takes a very strong-willed person
Absolutely.
To do that, and a certain yeah. personality even, and it's just very difficult. And that's why we have to change the social norms. We have to change the environment that we all live in to make the healthy choice the default and the easy choice.
Now, alcohol, that doesn't come with a nutrition label on it, does it?
No.
So how is this all legal?
Well, that's a good question, and I've actually asked some people, and it's probably mostly not legal. And in fact, the federal government, the federal agency that does regulate alcohol, has said alcohol companies are not allowed to make nutrition claims. However, they do allow certain additives because, you know, it's similar to food. There's pretty much federal agencies are asleep at the wheel. So, you know, they're able to get these products rubber stamped and then mark, and then we'll see, you know, whether anyone bothers to stop them from marketing them a certain way. So there have been some announcements from feds. For example, the wine industry has for years tried to slap a heart healthy claim on wine bottles, and the feds have said no, that there's, you know, we're not going to take a potentially deadly product and let you market it as a health food. You know, I mean, as much as the wine industry likes to claim to the contrary, alcohol, you know, wine does contain alcohol and it can kill you. And so, you know, we do have some regulations. The problem is they're not always enforced. And so when we see products that are being labeled as in the alcohol industry that are labeled as natural or, you know, with B vitamins, or my favorite is protein vodka, that's probably not legal, really. Or they do it in a way that's sly. They may not say protein is good for you. They'll just say it contains protein, which, you know, you kind of interpret on your own, may not be obviously deceptive. So, you know, it's just this is just the wild west of marketing claims that are out there in both food and alcohol. And unfortunately, we have a federal government that really doesn't have the capacity. I mean, you know, just to be fair, it's not just that industry calls the shots when it comes to policy, but it's also just the sad truth that we don't put enough dollars into proper oversight. And so the Food and Drug Administration is woefully underfunded, has been for many, many years, whether it comes to going after deceptive marketing claims or food safety. There simply aren't enough inspectors to go around. And so, and that's, of course, another game industry plays. If they don't like the policies, and they can always just starve the beast, and that's a very effective way of making sure that any government policies that are actually on the books don't get enforced. Sorry.
I want to scream. Okay, but there are things that we can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're seeing more public outcry, as you mentioned before, in pockets. You know, and another sad thing is how we treat our children, and that's done with the school lunch program. It seems sometimes that the worst of everything, if it doesn't sell or if it has problems or whatever, it gets into the school lunch program and we give it to our kids.
Yeah, well, how much more time do we have to talk about the school lunch program? So, you know, there has been an effort, again, going on for decades to try to improve school meals, and some of that has been successful. I mean, there are certainly sort of different programs and champions of healthy school food that have been successful. However, for the most part, school meals remain dismal, and because we don't have the likes of Ann Cooper, one of, you know, the more famous school chefs who's been extremely successful in her work, first in the Berkeley school system, and now she's based in Colorado. But, you know, we don't have enough of her to go around. There are others, mm-hmm. but, we, you know. So what happens is kids get fed, for the most part, you know, just awful food, highly processed. Increasingly, schools don't even have kitchens, so they're not even cooking food from scratch. They're just reheating it, which means they're getting all kinds of processed dreck from school food, just, you know, large food providers. So like Sodexo, Chartwell's, these are massive food companies that buy food from processors, and then they provide it to the schools kind of in heat and serve ways. And this is a system that's been, you know, going on for many years and, of course, again, benefits these processed food companies. And we have the added problem on top of the horrible school meals is what are called competitive foods. So these are foods sold outside the school meal program. They're a la carte foods that are sold on the school meal line, sometimes fast food. And then there's the whole vending machine and store school stores that sell almost all junk food, candy, ice cream, soda, you name it.
Right.
And, you know, this has been a problem that's we've gotten some traction on. There's over the years there's been efforts by, for example, almost every major city school district in the country has set fairly decent nutrition guidelines on the types of foods that can be sold through school vending machines. So New York has a very good policy. Seattle, L.A., Chicago, Boston, you know, the cities have really taken the lead on this. Unfortunately, we haven't seen all of that, you know, spread to the rest of the country, but there have been some improvements made there. But, you know, there's still a long way to go. And so, you know, what this comes down to often, unfortunately, is money, right, mm-hmm. that we don't prioritize school food enough, and so schools are left to deal with what amounts to a dollar a meal to, you know, who can eat for, you know, you can get a value meal at McDonald's for a dollar, or
right.
just a cheeseburger, I guess, but, you know, that's just to show you what the average food service provider is left to deal with in school. So, you know, there was an effort to increase the amount of money per meal with the School Food Act that was passed last year, and to her credit, the First Lady really championed that piece of legislation. It did increase the reimbursement rate, as it's called, by 6 cents. They wanted double that, but we're only able to get 6 more cents per meal, so woohoo, now we have $1.06 to play with. Clearly still not enough to improve meals considerably. Now, there are creative ways to, you know, to deal with that, but again, you need schools that are willing to cook, which means spending more on staff, because obviously that's labor and so forth. So, you know, it's a very complicated web.
Right. But I read that it's not necessarily more expensive to get local people back into the kitchen and preparing meals.
Yeah, I think it depends. I think I saw the article that you were referring to, and it was a little oversimplified. Mm. I think the point that article was making is that schools think that by sort of farming out the processing, so part of what goes on with school meals is that commodity foods like chicken and cheese and, you know, all manner of animal products are sent off to processors like Tyson to kind of, you know, bone the chicken and turn them into nuggets, and then they get shipped back to schools. And, you know, the argument is, well, the money that was paying Tyson we should be keeping in the schools and, you know, doing something more healthy with chicken than turning it into nuggets. But, you know, I don't think it's that simple. I mean, because in Tyson, being such a massive company, is able to, you know, work more cheaply than hiring someone in every school district to do that job. So, you know, plus they're shipping it to China, by the way. I mean, there's all kinds of stories of food being shipped to be processed and then shipped back. I mean,
that's
economics of scale. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the bottom line is the bottom line. We do need more money. And even if some of the way schools are now spending money doesn't make sense, and I'm certain that that's true, we still need more money to help them to do a better job.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about price fixing. You have an article about the dairy industry making a killing by killing cows in the food safety news.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly a very interesting thing. A lot of people think that prices for food is based on the simple theory of supply and demand, and there's a lot more to it than that.
Right. Well, you know, price fixing is a tricky one, and the article I wrote was to draw attention to a lawsuit that was filed based on research uncovered that showed the dairy industry has been engaged in price fixing, and in that particular situation, they did so by killing 500,000 cows. And I will say this practice isn't that unique. I mean, unfortunately, what tends to happen in the dairy industry especially is that when prices fall, there's a glut on the market, and you can't just, as dairy farmers like to tell me, you can't just turn off the cows. So, you know, like in any other kind of factory situation, you can just stop production when there's a glut on the market. Obviously, it's different when you're dealing with actual animals. And so in order to, you know, keep them going out of business from an increase of supply, they will cull the herd, as it's called. And so they kill animals in order to put some brakes on the glut of milk in the market, and that increases prices because, you know, simple supply and demand. In this case, they did this probably illegally, because it's one thing to do that. It's another thing to have an entire industry agree to do it. And the sort of definition of antitrust is when industry members come together and agree. Now, again, they have argued back to me that this is something that is allowed, that dairy industry has an exception to antitrust rules, and that is also true to some extent. However, it's not true when it comes to trade groups. And in this case, these were trade groups who engaged in this practice. So the dairy industry is extremely complex, both sort of in corporate structure and in pricing. And the other thing I wanted to draw attention to with that article is how we have a number of government policies that really help dairy farmers by keeping prices up. And, you know, this may have made sense back in the early part of last century, like many of our agricultural policies did early on, to be helping small farmers, you know, earn a living and to be helping people get access to food. And, you know, I don't have a problem with some dairy in a diet, but the problem is this has all kind of gotten out of control. And now we have a situation where, of course, the dairy industry has completely brainwashed Americans to think that dairy is an essential part of the diet, and that has gone along with government supports over the years, and that is what keeps the dairy industry humming along, but really only at these very high kind of consolidated corporate mega farming levels. Small dairy farmers have, for the most part, gone out of business, and that's the real crime here. That we're not talking about, you know, a few cows here and there, which, mm-hmm. again, would be okay if it was just a small part of our diet. We're talking about huge concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, which is how the federal government refers to them. And these are just factories of animals churning out the least healthy type of dairy, and all of it pretty much very much supported by our federal taxes.
These factory farms, these CAFOs, are probably one of the worst things that humanity has ever come up with. Not only are they horrifically cruel, the quote food that they produce is really marginal in terms of health benefits, and it's certainly devastating on the environment. Is there any hope to see these things go away? You know, I read all kinds of articles, especially what's going on globally, where the trend is to have more of this than less of it.
Mm-hmm. How depressed do you want to be? Yeah, you're right. Globally, it's pretty scary, because what's happening is, as the American market and the Western market, so North America, Europe, as these markets get saturated with animal products, industry has nowhere to go but the developing world. And, of course, China, India look to America and the West as, you know, this is what they want, right? Because who would want to stay in poverty? Of course, they want to have the same types of comforts that we have. But the problem is, along with that goes our unhealthy way of eating. And so we're definitely seeing, and increasingly our meat production here is being exported to these other countries. But even more scary is, like you say, the CAFOs that are being now sort of replicated in other parts of the world. And it's you know, probably one of the scariest things I can think of, because not only for the horror of the animals and for their health, but for the wreckage of the planet. I mean, we know there's just a direct connection between factory farming and global warming and destruction of our soil, and, you know, you name the environmental hazard, and it can be connected in some way to factory farming. So it's pretty bad, the idea of spreading the horrors that we've created here in this country to other countries. And all I can say is, you know, when the you-know-what hits the fan is really only when perhaps we might wake up to realize we've done something very wrong.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll get smart before it gets too horrible. But it already
late.
Is kind of horrible.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you familiar with the Farm Bill?
I am.
Because
not intimately,
like,
not as much as some others, but
I just all I know is when I read about it, it is so overwhelming and so confusing and so convoluted. And if there's any light to be shed on it, I would like to see it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's another one of these, you know, massive pieces of legislation that is deliberately kept obscure to keep real people from paying attention. Of course, the big agribusiness lobbyists are paying complete attention because they're the ones right in there writing the bill. And but it is really important, and I think some other, you know, writers have really done a good job of getting this issue out there, at least to those of us that are paying attention. In other words, people who have previously only thought about, you know, the health impacts of our diet are now starting to understand that our agricultural policies are deeply connected to the food choices that are even available to us. And the Farm Bill is one of the, you know, most important vehicles for that connection between ag policy and health. And so one of the, you know, biggest components that has gotten the most attention is farm subsidies. So the Farm Bill is where our where we say how much money goes to subsidize all the wrong things. And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, the biggest crops to get subsidized are things like corn and soy, which go not to feed, you know, people with corn on the cob or, you know, tofu. Rather, most soy and corn goes to feed animals. And it's these cheap inputs into the factory farms that keep our highly animal product-centered and processed food-centered diet, because it's both inputs for feed, as well as things like corn syrup and hydrogenated oils, which are a huge component of processed food. So so this is a problem that, you know, again, the growing body of activists and advocates from various corners have come to recognize. The problem is the Farm Bill only comes around every 5 years, and as a colleague of mine calls it, who says it's like the Olympics, it's a spectator sport. And so, you know, we haven't quite figured out what to do about it. And we're actually in going into the next version of the Farm Bill, which is for 2012, and we'll see how it goes. Things aren't looking very good because, of course, we're in budget cut mode, and the GOB is proposing, while some cuts to subsidies, which is a good thing, also in the Farm Bill and also very important are the nutrition programs, so things like food stamps and the WIC program, which are becoming more and more important, of course, as the economy continues to spiral downward. More people need these vital safety net programs that we have. So, no, the fight's going to be really where the, not whether to cut at all, but where the cuts are going to come from.
Right. Is there anything we can do, the general public?
Yes. You know, I just recommend people get involved kind of wherever they can. So I can't tell you, like, go join this group or go, you know, to the X school. I say find the point of entry that makes sense for you, that really has meaning for you. If you have kids in school and you want to see the school meal program improved, you know, see who else you can find in that school, parents, teachers, principal, et cetera, to help make that happen. If the Farm Bill is something that, you know, gets you excited, there are no shortage of groups to help support, volunteer with, et cetera, to get engaged with. And, you know, whether it's at, you know, and anything in between. So at every level, whether it's at school, local level, community level, or statewide groups, there's a great farm-to-school program, which operates in almost every state, and then there are federal organizations that are working hard every day to try to improve our policy to fix this mess. And so, you know, these days, especially in the age of internet, anyone with a computer can find a way to get involved.
Right, absolutely. Well, I think that should be, if people are making New Year's resolutions, getting more involved would be a good one on any level.
Absolutely, Michelle? And if you have time to volunteer, great. If you don't have time, then donate some money. Even $10 would help.
Right, and also everything you buy, think about where each dollar is going and what you're supporting with your dollars, because that's really where it all happens. If we're not buying the products that we don't believe in, they go away.
Right. Well, I say it's a two-prong approach. One is to start with, you know, how you eat. And, of course, we each have a responsibility to shop responsibly. But the thing is, it can't stop there. And so then to take the next step and make sure that the same access that you have is available to everyone. And that's really where policy change comes in.
Okay. Well, Michelle Simon, thank you so much for everything you do. Thank you for joining me at this hour of It's All About Food. I hope you have a really lovely holiday season here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Karen.
And your websites again, eatdrinkpolitics.com and appetiteforprofit.com. Thank you again.
Sure.
I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. We are in that holiday season time. Lots of lovely, rich foods going on out there. And I want to remind you that while you're having a good time, while you're having those great treats and things, don't forget to eat your greens. They're what's going to help you detox, stay strong, have lots of energy. And if you go to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, you can watch the food show that we just created last week called It's All About Greens, and gives you great tips on juicing, steaming, salading, smoothieing, all the ways to get your greens, so get them. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food, and that's it. And I'll be back next week with two great guests, Laura Theodore, the jazzy vegetarian, and Lathan Thomas, talking about greening the planet one belly at a time. Have a delicious week.